Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Environmental Law and Property Rights Practice Group, was recorded on Tuesday, January 14, 2014, during a live Courthouse Steps teleform conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Practice Group Teleform Conference Call. We'll be discussing today a special Courthouse Steps edition of Teleform. We'll be discussing the Marvin M. Brandt Revocable Trust versus United States case argued earlier today in the U.S. Supreme Court. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call, and also we're recording today's call for use as a podcast in the future. We're happy to welcome to today's call two experts. I think it might be the first time we've had a husband and wife team as our hosts here on the Teleform conference call. We're going to hear opening remarks from each of them of about 10 minutes. And then, as always, we're going to ask for your questions, so please be ready with your questions. We'll hear first from Nancy Marzullo. She's a partner at the Marzullo Law Firm right here in Washington, D.C., followed by Roger Marzullo, also a partner at Marzullo Law here in D.C. And with that, Nancy Marzullo, please go right ahead with your opening remarks.
Thank you, Dean. It's a pleasure to be here today talking to you about a very interesting case with significant property law and property rights implications. As Dean said, Roger Marzullo and I had the pleasure today of attending the oral argument in the U.S. Supreme Court, and I can report that the argument today was a very lively argument. We had all eight justices who normally participate in these arguments, orally that is, jumping in with active questioning. And one justice would ask a question, and then another justice a few minutes later would pick up the same question, and you might even have a third justice pick up the same question. They were very avidly interested in the issues posed by this case, and it made for a very engaging hour of oral argument that went by very, very quickly. As Dean said, this is Brandt versus United States. And this case involves kind of from an overarching perspective, it involves grand land use schemes by the federal government that started in the early 1800s when the West was being settled and railroads were being established, and it became the federal policy to support the expansion of railroads to crisscross the United States by the grant of rights away to the railroads. This policy changed in about 1871 to favor homesteading, the private, ultimate private acquisition and ownership of land from the transfer of the land to railroad use to private ownership. And then we find ourselves today where the overarching policy of land use by the United States seems to be in favor of hiking and biking. So that's this case really reaches across decades of what the government favors in terms of land use policy. So this case arose out of a right-of-way that was granted originally in 1908 by the United States to the Laramie Hans Peak and Pacific Railroad Company, and this company was granted a right-of-way over public land under the 1875, ultimately the lot rights were then under the 1875 General Railroad Right-of-Way Act. The acts were governed by that statute. And there are literally thousands of miles of similar rights-of-way also granted under this statute, and that will be directly affected by the ruling in this case. So The Laramie Hans Peak and Pacific Railroad Company obtained a 200-foot right-of-way about 66 miles long. And then in 1976, the United States transferred ownership of about 83.32 acres of land known as Fox Park, Wyoming, to Melvin and Lulu Brandt. And they transferred this land by patent deed to the Brandts, and part of the Laramie Hans right-of-way traversed the Brandts' property. Now, the patent deed expressly reserved rights-of-ways in the Brandts' patent deed, and these rights-of-ways were reserved for ditches and canals and for two U.S. Forest Service roads. The patent further provided that the ownership by the Brandts of this land was subject, and I'm quoting here, subject to those rights for railroad purposes as have been granted to the Laramie Hans Peak and Pacific Railroad Company, its successors or assigns under the Act of 1875. In 1942, the U.S. Supreme Court issued a ruling that interpreted this 1875 Act, construing these rights-of-ways as easements, and that the easement granted to the railway was just that, and even the underlying mineral interest over which the easement traversed belonged to the United States as the underlying patent holder, or in the case of the Brandts, it would be the Brandts as the underlying patent holder. So now we reach current events. In 1996, the Laramie Hans Successor and Interest Railway Company took steps to abandon its right-of-way, including its portion of the right-of-way that traversed the Brandts' property, and abandonment was formally consummated in 2004. In 2006, the United States filed suit in U.S. District Court in the District of Wyoming, seeking a judicial decree of abandonment, and it is there that the ownership of the underlying fee became front and center. The United States also in 2006 sought to quiet title in the reversionary interest of the property over which the easement had been granted, and they sought to quiet title against the Brandts as well as the other affected property owners. The Brandts counterclaimed, seeking to quiet title in to the property in themselves. And the district court, interestingly, and the Tenth Circuit Court of Appeals held in favor of the United States. They held that the United States held title to the reversionary interest, and they did so on the basis of a subsequent provision that was enacted by Congress that purported to construe the 1875 Act and purported to vest in the United States a reversionary interest for the rights of way under the 1875 Act. Now, this is, of course, what the United States relies on. This is a subsequent provision. But as the Brandts pointed out in oral argument and in their briefs, the subsequent provision, Section 912 to be specific, does not purport to amend the 1875 Act. And the 1942 decision by the United States Supreme Court, the Great Northern Railway Company versus the United States, is the case that the Brandts rely on. It defines the reversionary the interest being conveyed as an easement, and that there is nothing that purports to convey a reversionary interest to anyone other than the underlying fee landowner. So Great Northern, that 1942 decision was front and center. That was the case that was debated by both parties with the branch relying on it, and the United States, the SG's office, arguing that an earlier decided decision, Stringham in particular, should be the case that should be relied on by the Supreme Court. And all of the justices asked very hard questions of the SG's office about why Great Northern should not be the controlling case. The very first question asked by Justice Scalia of the attorney from the SG's office was to congratulate the SG's office on having won the award for understatement by describing the Great Northern Railway Company decision as perhaps having something to say about the issue, when in point of fact, he, as well as the other justices, found the Great Northern decision to be pretty much on point. So with that, Roger, why don't I turn the discussion over to you, and you talk to us a little about some of the points that the justices made.
Great. Thanks, Nancy. What's the big deal about this case? Well, it is, as the parties referenced it, an issue, first of all, that may affect thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people. Large tracts of land, we heard discussion of everything from thousands to a million or more acres. And what was most interesting on this, if you will, empirical point, was that neither party was able to provide the court with answers to the critical questions of how much land is involved, how many people are involved, what will be the impact of this case, will it run up $1 billion in takings litigation, a point of particular interest to Nancy and myself, a point that the Solicitor General's office was unable to respond to was, well, how many acres of this land does the United States claim that it owns? Answer, we don't know. Well, don't you have records of what the United States claims to own? No, we really don't. We don't know what land the United States owns, and we certainly don't know what strips of former railroad track the United States might own. So the court, I think it's fair to say, walked away quite unsatisfied with the answers it received with respect to this lack of information, Brandeis brief material, if you will, relating to the case and the implications of its decision. On a related but a separate inquiry, the court was particularly concerned about this issue of settled expectations and reliance. So in addition to inquiring about who was involved, how much land, how much money, the court looked to the question, and numerous justices on both sides of the aisle were concerned about the fact that the United States, in arguing the Great Northern case in 1942, had argued that this was an easement. And that is consistent, of course, with the position that the landowner now takes, and is the opposite, is the position that the United States is arguing against now. Indeed, Justice Roberts read from the headings of the United States brief back in the Great Northern case in 1942, headings that ran something like, the 1875 statute demonstrates that this grant is an easement, the legislative history demonstrates that it is an easement, the congressional mood and history demonstrate that it's an easement, and government's lawyer started really wriggling at this point, came up with a position that it was an easement for some purposes and a fee reversionary interest for other purposes, at which point Scalia and Breyer, who interestingly teamed up on this one and were on the same side. By the way, I call this one as a clear win for the property owner, and the only question in my mind is if it's going to be unanimous. They teamed up in saying, can you name us any case in which or any circumstance in which a property interest has been held to be both a fee and an easement? Doesn't it have to be one or the other? Well, what became painfully obvious as we went down this discussion of settled expectations, and this should be of primary interest to those of you who, like Nancy and me, practice law in the field of property rights, was the fundamental importance of using the traditional background principles of property law as a foundational point, as a reference point, a pole star for where the rights of ownership are to be found, so that to the extent that this is called an easement, we then know what it is. And there was sound rejection by all of the justices of the government's argument that, well, it's not really a question of what you call it, but of where it fits in the congressional definitional category. In point of fact, what did seem to be missing was any sufficient property rights or real property research and learning on the part of the justices, and I have to suggest that must go down to their clerks as well. Justice Breyer kept grasping for the concept of springing use but couldn't remember what it was called, and said he remembered something from first-year property law, but he couldn't remember really what it was called. And Justice Scalia also referenced his learning back in first year of property law from Professor Kasner. What the case was lacking, and where I think the outcome is really going to turn, and where I think we're going to see a variance between the case as presented as a legislative interpretation case, and the case as decided, I think is going to be much more a property rights case. Is going to be some discussion of the nature of easement, the nature of fee ownership, the concept of conveyancing and what a patent deed does convey, and the ultimate implications for property rights lawyers as well as real property lawyers, in addition to the question of what do people own, is how is this going to affect the rails-to-trails litigation, in which thus far the Federal Circuit has held that the easement reverted to the underlying property owner. If the government wins this one, that easement in all cases where the railroad right-of-way was granted under the 1875 Act, and there's some where it was not, but in those where it was, and that's the majority, the reversion would go to the United States, in which case the property owner would have no claim of right. The other thing that a win for the United States would accomplish here would be that we would have these strips, what Justice Kagan referred to as spaghetti strings of land, thousands of miles long and 100 feet wide across the United States, running, as Justice Breyer suggested, through people's living rooms that would be owned by the United States. So it would clearly upset settled expectations, and I was pleased to see that the court found that very troubling and wanted to cleave to traditional notions of real property and property rights. With that, Dean, I think we're open to taking questions.
Well, let me just, Dean, if I could, let me just, I want to let people, the listeners know that the amicus support that the two parties had in this case, because I think that further illustrates the importance of this case. Steve Lechner argued for the Brants, and he, of course, is with Mountain States Legal Foundation, who represented the Brants. And in support of Brant, The grants, we had the Northwest Legal Foundation, the Cato Institute, the National Association of Reversionary Property Owners, Pacific Legal Foundation, and the New England Legal Foundation. In support of the government, we had the Rails to Trails Conservancy, the National Conference of State Legislatures, and the states of New Mexico, Oregon, and Washington. So this is a case that a lot of people are watching, and I agree with you, Roger. I count at least five votes, and I was mightily encouraged by the questions from, as Roger put it, both sides of the aisle that were concerned about settled expectations, not doing violence to establish notions of property law. So this could be a winning decision for the brands.
All right. Let's turn to the audience now. In a moment, we're all going to hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After that, if you have a question, you push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question for either Roger or Nancy Marzullo, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Before we go to the first question, let me make a programming announcement. Tomorrow at 2 p.m., we'll have another Courthouse Steps teleforum, this one discussing McCullen versus Coakley. That's the sidewalk protest case that comes out of Massachusetts that's being argued tomorrow in the court. So at the same number, tomorrow, 2 p.m. Eastern Time, we'll have another Courthouse Steps edition of teleforum. Next week, we have calls scheduled so far on two other Supreme Court cases on a new book by Clark Forsythe called Abuse of Discretion, and we'll likely add others. It's quite possible that even later this week we'll add a call on the Verizon versus FCC net neutrality case decided yesterday in the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals. So in addition to monitoring your emails, take a look at our website for updates. Again, today we're talking to Roger and Nancy Marzullo. If you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. We've got one caller question, so let's go to that first caller.
John Rowland, Constitution.org. If sovereignty over the land passed to each state when the state was admitted, then state laws, in particular state laws on adverse possession, would seem to apply. If the property has been abandoned, if it's the boundaries and possession of it has not been defended for a sufficiently long period of time. So is anyone invoking squatters' rights? That would seem to be what it's all about.
John, I wish they were in this one. We've litigated that issue. We had a case out in Nevada about 20 years ago. What was the name of the county?
Nye
County case, where the county commissioners actually asserted jurisdiction over the federal lands, and that's the third largest county in the country with the largest holding of federal lands. Unfortunately, the case didn't come out the way we had hoped. I'm afraid that the settled law has gone the opposite way, that is that the United States continues to own land despite the equal footing doctrine and a principle that you lay out, which I think is quite arguable and which I'd love to see adopted, and that is that the United States did not retain ownership when the states became sovereign. Short answer to your question, no, I'm afraid that sovereignty argument was not made. What I think is important in this case, however, is that the court does recognize the importance of private property ownership of land that formerly was held by the United States, and that the United States doesn't retain any right to subsequently change or alter the conveyance, that the United States should be bound by the same principles, same rules of conveyancing as any private party, that the rules, in short, of real property law and property rights that we are acquainted with at least do apply when the United States conveys title to a private party. And that's one that has been challenged previously, and it seems to be holding firm in the United States Supreme Court, at least as of today.
Yes, I think that's an important point, and I think Roger alluded to this, but I think it's worth underscoring. The justices today struggled with recalling basic principles of real property law. That being said, they all understood the fact that there was something really wrong with the idea that the United States could claim, by implication, a reservation in land that the government itself agrees has been transferred to private ownership by patent deed. And there is no express reservation in the patent deed except that it is subject to the easement or the right-of-way under the Act of 1875, which was expressly for railroad use, not for hiking and biking. So I thought the justices on the court came at this from a very useful, principled way in terms of the way they analyzed the issue, not as knowledgeable as one might hope about real property law, but they'll get there. I mean, Justice Breyer said, I'm going to have my law clerk look this up.
And Kagan, Sotomayor, you know, it wasn't just the usual suspects.
Great. Once again, if you have a question, push the star button and the pound button on your telephone. At this point, we've got three callers with questions. Let's take another question.
Hello, Luke Wake with the NFIB Legal Center. We joined with the Owners Council of America in basically filing an amicus arguing that we were concerned about the government essentially redefining property rights, and had two questions related to that. First, you know, this has always struck me as essentially a, you know, a statutory issue, but with obviously property rights implications in the background. But what are the chances, in your view, that they some of the justices, at least in the concurrence or maybe in the opinion itself, might actually say something substantive about the takings clause and takings principles? And secondly, I know there's some opinion, some case law out there that has allowed the government in some situations to change its course during a specific litigation and take a position that it has been contrary to what it had said earlier in the litigation. And, I'm wondering, is it likely the court's going to say anything about judicial estoppel here as well?
Well, the first issue, why don't I take the first issue, and Roger, you take the second issue. The first issue, the takings issue, certainly Sotomayor and maybe Kagan as well specifically raised the issue of whether the landowners would have takings claims if the court were to rule in favor of the United States in this case. So they're very much aware of the fact that the ramifications could well be takings liability if vested rights suddenly are extinguished by virtue of this decision. That being said, I'm not sure that we can expect for the court to do much beyond make mention of the fact that there might be takings claims that would result from a decision if it rules the United States' favor. I think what we can more likely expect from the court in this decision, and both Roger and I agree that we believe, and I hope we're right, that this is going to be a decision in favor of the branch. I think what we're going to get is a discussion of the nature of easements and reversionary interests. In other words, it'll be the nature of the property right that will be discussed in this case. Clearly, it is a statutory case in construing the 1875 statute, but we're the deed, the reservation in the deed, and then the nature of the right-of-way, which is an easement, under the Great Northern Railway Company decision of 1942. I really think that's going to be what the decision focuses on. Roger?
Yeah, and Luke, let me congratulate you on the brief you all filed, which I thought was very, very helpful, and made some excellent points. Judicial estoppel. We've argued that a number of times, and it has fallen on deaf ears, and I think that other parties have had pretty much the same result when you're dealing with the government. Indeed, there are some principles, as you may know, that apply specifically to the government, that it's not bound by the same res judicata principles that individuals are. I'm embarrassed to say it happened during the Reagan administration that the Solicitor General successfully argued that the United States could take different positions in different district courts so as to bring a case forward and bubble up to the Supreme Court. Otherwise, the first decision would fix the law and they'd be stuck with it everywhere else. That being said, Luke, what the justices did, I think, was to accomplish the same purpose by saying, come on, the conveyance to the branch, which actually took place in the 1970s, was made in the shadow of the existing law, the existing Supreme Court decision, existing regulations that define this as an easement, so forth. And in fact, Breyer pushed the United States lawyer, the Solicitor General's guy, to saying, you know, suppose a real estate lawyer worth his salt were advising the Brants in 1971 when they were receiving this conveyance, wouldn't he say, well, it's subject to an easement? And wriggle as he might, I don't think the Solicitor General's representative managed to get out of that. So it's not called judicial estoppel. It's sort of called settled expectations. But I was very pleased to see that the Supreme Court was not going to let the United States do a complete turnabout. In fact, I think it was either Sotomayor or Kagan who said, so it's an easement when you want it to be an easement. It's a fee when you want it to be a fee. It just depends on whether you want the property back or not, right? And I think that came across loud and clear to the court.
Let's take another question. We've got two questions at this point. If you want to join the queue, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone.
This is Jack Park. Thank you, Roger and Nancy. Was there any discussion of the Leo Sheep case, which followed Great Northern in Leo Sheep, among other things? Chief Justice Rehnquist pointed the government to its eminent domain powers as an answer to a government claim for property.
Yes. Steve Lechner started out by discussing Leo Sheep. Of course, that's a wonderful decision relied on in a number of different contexts. He began by discussing Leo Sheep and then led into the Great Northern decision. So it was certainly discussed as sort of a background of this body of the law. But I think the sort of pivotal case here that certainly the Brants rely on and the SG is trying to erode its significance is the Great Northern Railway Company case.
Yeah. I'd like to kind of add to that. Leo Sheep is important. And as I recall, I know that Mountain States, back when Nancy and I were both at Mountain States in the early 1980s, was involved in the Leo Sheep case. And I forget if they represented the plaintiff or were interveners. But in any event, Leo Sheep held that the United States, like any other private party, was bound by the terms of its conveyance and that there were no sort of implied property rights that were retained by the United States when it conveyed property. That was an issue in this argument, and it sort of underlies what I said about the importance of real property law in general, conveyancing law in particular. One argument that Justice Kagan hit on and that I hope she will develop was the one that Nancy adverted to earlier. The patent from the United States only reserves the right-of-way for railroad purposes. It does not reserve a right of reverter in the event the property should cease to be used for railroad purposes. So it seems to me there's a very straightforward argument that I did not, it is not in the party's briefs, but that I think Justice Kagan hit on, which is even if the United States had this reversionary interest, it conveyed that reversionary interest through this patent deed by failing to reserve the reversion. The only thing it accepted was a railroad right-of-way, which was not a right of the United States, but rather the right of the Laramie, et cetera, railroad.
We've got one question pending at this point. If you'd like to ask a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Before we go to our next caller, let me get a question in here, if I could, Nancy and Roger. And that is, one of you mentioned, I think maybe it was Roger, who talked about an inability of either party to talk with any specificity about the number of property owners that might be affected here. I take it that cuts in favor of the Brants here, that the more property owners, and the more doubt about how many there are, it seemed, in your mind, to cut in favor of the Brants and the other property owners. Is that the case? And is there any chance at all that a case like this would be remanded for that part of the record to be developed? Or?
Well, that's an excellent question, Dean. Yes, I think, first of all, the point of the question was, if there are that many people affected, that impacts the analysis by the judges themselves. It impacts the notion of settled expectations sort of as a factual matter in the real world. I didn't get the sense that it might be remanded, but what I would say to those of you, and there were quite a number who filed amicus briefs, and I know there are a number of people on the phone today who file amicus briefs regularly in the U.S. Supreme Court, that it's worth keeping in mind that is the sort of role that an amicus can play that can be extraordinarily helpful to the court in the end. You could say, theoretically, the United States Supreme Court decides constitutional issues and it shouldn't matter whether it affects only one person or thousands of people. But in truth, I think we all know that the impact of a decision does have an effect on the decision of the judges. And I think it would have been very helpful if instead of just sort of alluding to the idea that we think there, you know, we're pretty sure there are thousands of people out there and maybe hundreds of thousands of acres, it'd really be nice to have some kind of numbers, some kind of indication on that. And the other end of that, as I say, it always it grates on me, and it's a pet peeve of mine, that somebody asks, well, isn't this going to cost us a lot of money in takings litigation? Which is to say, aren't we going to have to live up to our constitutional obligation to pay if we take people's property? But I do think that because the government always relies on that, plays the takings liability card, that would be a very helpful thing for people to talk about too. It's not going to make that much difference in terms of takings liability. The property's not that valuable. It's in Wyoming, for God's sake. And in the end, once you winnow out all the people who won't bring cases and so forth and so on, it's always a drop in the bucket, and yet the government loves to wave this flag. The United States is going to go bankrupt if we have to pay for property rights.
Yeah, let me just add one quick point. First of all, I think it's important to appreciate, as Roger said, that this was a question that the justices were very troubled by. Across the board, all of the justices were concerned that you had people that had relied for decades on
on their decision.
On their ownership of the reversionary interest. Let me also say, however, that the SG's office got stung, I thought, pretty sharply by their being unable to offer any notion of how much land that they claimed they owned. Chief Justice Roberts really pushed the fellow from the, Mr. Yang from the SG's office, who could offer not even a hazard, he couldn't hazard a guess as to how much land that the United States claimed title to. And I think that was put the government in a very weak position.
We've got just one question pending at this point. If you'd like to ask a question, you need to push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Let's go to our next caller.
Hi, this is Ilya Shapiro from the Cato Institute. We filed a brief. Thankfully, Thor Hearn wrote it. Otherwise, I'd be scrambling for the dregs of my 1L learning on property law as well. Thanks very much for this discussion. I wasn't able to go to the court this morning. I have a more court-watching question, and that is both of you seem to be optimistic about the branch chances, and Nancy, you mentioned that there's probably 5 votes. I wonder if you could tease that out a little more. Do you think this is going to be a conventional 5-4, or what the lineup might be? Or perhaps you're just optimistic, but you have no idea because nobody seems to know anything about property law. So just talk a little bit more about that dynamic and how useful any prediction at this point might be.
Well, of course, any prediction is just any prediction. But I think if we came up with the 5, it would be the conventional 5. But Roger goes so far as to say we might have a clean sweep, and I would be tempted to agree with him because Breyer really led the arguments and pushed the SG's office hard on this case. Kagan came out with very good questions. One of her pointed questions was, the way I see this case is the United States really didn't pay much attention to this land. It doesn't know how much land that it claims it owns and really didn't think much about the 1875 Act at all until it all of a sudden woke up one day and said, it'd be really nice to have some biking and hiking trails across this land. Why don't we claim that we own the reversionary interest? That's a pretty devastating view of the case coming from Justice Kagan. And Sotomayor, again, concerned about the settled expectations. So we could get a clean sweep on this case.
We do have another caller, so let's now go to our next caller. Again, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Let's go to our next caller.
Yeah, hey, Roger and Nancy, this is Bill Mullins, and it's nice to hear you all give this report. As you may recall, I represent railroads, and I've been listening with interest here because this has not gotten a lot of play in the railroad press or the railroad world, and I was just wondering whether my clients, railroads, are missing the boat, or are we proper being neutral and not really caring, or should we be concerned?
So I think you're sort of out of the picture, aren't you? I mean, the railroad company here abandoned the easement, and that was consummated in 2004. So this is, I don't think you really have a dog in this hunt.
Well, and that's true. I mean, I'm just, this has become such an issue with railroads and the rails to trails, and did the railroad really have authority to grant the rails to trails? And I'm glad to hear you say that. I think that's the right answer, and probably why we haven't heard much from the railroad industry. But I'm just wondering, if there was a decision in his favor, if it would create some sort of maybe reluctance upon the railroads to enter into rails to trails, or maybe we should be more cautious to do that?
Well, you know, Bill, I do think this is something that is worth pursuing a little bit because it does impact the rails to trails issues, and your clients do get tangled up in that a bit when they decide to abandon. And I'm sure one of the things they have to think about is, well, what's going to happen here? The related issue, it seems to me, is that it would make a difference if what the railroad got was, as the government claims, a defeasible fee. Because I think a defeasible fee, that is a fee subject to condition precedent, although Justice Breyer couldn't think of that.
A springing
concept,
interest is what he
That the analysis of what constitutes abandonment and whether, in fact, it automatically reverts, I think it would make a difference. If I were a railroad, if I were the real estate lawyer for a railroad, I would want to say, well, whether it's an easement or whether it's a fee subject to defeasance probably makes some kind of difference in how I'm going to run my railroad. So besides which, we want to bring you over to help out the property owners.
Yeah, well, you know my heart is with the property owners, and every time one of my clients wants to do the rails to trails, I cringe. But that's why I'm very interested in this case, and thank you all for your efforts here. It sounds wonderful.
Well, let's get together for lunch and talk about this. Huh?
Well, it's nice. Thank you. We should do that.
I think, though, that in terms of how this decision is going to come out, I'm not sure that unless you have language identical to this, I mean, this reservation expressly says that the right-of-way is for railroad purposes. So I think that's pretty cut and dry. And once that has been abandoned by the railroad is not in this case.
All right. We now have two more questions. I suppose that term could be interpreted to mean that for railroading purposes of railroading the landowners, perhaps. but let's go to our next call.
Afternoon. This is David Burge in Atlanta, Georgia. Given that this case sounds like it's going to be decided as a fairly routine, you know, deed construction matter, if you will, do you have any guess what attracted the Supreme Court's interest in it? Property law is not an area that that has a lot of federal issues and a lot of constitutional issues. So what got their interest in the first place?
Well, I think the Tenth Circuit decision itself invited Supreme Court review because you recall that this case came up with the Brandts losing at the district court level and at the Tenth Circuit, and the Tenth Circuit conceded that there was a split and that Great Northern would appear to control the issue, but it ruled contrary to the Great Northern Railway ruling. And so right there, you've got the Tenth Circuit Court of Appeals saying, you know, we think there's some confusion here. There's circuits going in different directions. So that sets up a clear invitation to the Supreme Court to take a look at what's going on.
Yeah, I would add to that first of all, the United States set this up as a test case. They brought a quiet title action in district court in Wyoming within the Tenth Circuit, knowing that the Tenth Circuit was likely to rule in their favor because of an existing precedent there, and knowing that that would be a split with the federal circuit where people like Thor Hearn are creaming the United States on rails to trails cases. I think it was a backdoor to try to undo rails to trails takings litigation and to try to boost the rails to trails effort. And I think the Supreme Court was at least aware of the linkage between this seemingly obscure issue and the whole Rails to Trails movement. And the other thing that they were impacted by is I think there was reference to there being thousands of people, tens of thousands of property owners out there. I think that did capture their imagination.
All right, we've got another question. Let's go to our next caller.
This is Jack Park. It's just an observation about the railroad interests. The conveyance is under the 1875 Act, and there were prior conveyances that might or might not go the same way in creating the interest. And I think my instinct is that most of the 1875 Act conveyances are out in the western part of the United States. And I guess you can see that from the amicus brief from some of the states that want the rails to trails, who came in on the side of the United States.
Yeah, I think that's right, Jack. The 1875 Act, and for that matter, the grants to the railroads going back to the 1840s, 50s, 60s, were an effort to open the West to, they were part of that great tying together of the Pacific and the Atlantic with a railroad. And frankly, Congress, I think at that time, looked at sort of the middle of the United States as a vast wasteland and didn't really worry about the value of this property. Maybe didn't even foresee at the time that it would become populated and privately owned. There was this huge, vast space that ran through the central United States that had virtually no population, nothing there, and getting the railroads out there was of prime importance. So I think that's sort of what explains what Congress did then, and now we find ourselves with changed circumstances, and one of the key issues always in the property rights field is where do we go with property rights? Do we change them sort of like the living constitution concept to adapt to modern circumstances, or are they a fixed point of reference and property rights have to be either purchased or otherwise properly regulated within the bounds of the Fifth Amendment?
We're just about out of time. It looks like we're out of questions, but let me see if each of you or either of you, Roger, Nancy, Marzullo, have a final statement or final thought you want to make before we adjourn.
I'll just add that I think the point Roger just made is an important one, and one thing that the SG's office said that was particularly jarring is that the statutory provision and the use of the term right-of-way has to be understood in the context of the times. And I think the point that a number of the justices made is a right-of-way is an easement and an easement is an easement, and these are sort of known terms of property law. And an easement in 1875 means the same thing as it does today. It's not a changing notion of what a property right is.
Originally,
Roger, do you have a final thought?
Only that original intent is still alive and well, and I'm glad to see it, and I want to urge all of you who are in the property rights movement, keep up the good work.
Let me thank both Roger and Nancy Marzullo and suggest that we might want to have you back when this case is decided and we have an opinion or a number of opinions to deal with. So thank you both for joining us today, and of course, thank you for attending the oral argument. To our audience, I encourage you to join us for our next scheduled teleforum conference call. That's tomorrow at 2 p.m. Again, we'll be looking at a courthouse steps teleforum, this one on McCullen versus Coakley, the Massachusetts sidewalk protest case. But until then, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.